this was not said from sort of pure goodwill for the people, but obviously these people were shaking, these actors were shaking in their boots. They had somehow to mobilize these forces. And then, of course, there developed the terrible temptation to mobilize them against one's rivals, so that a kind of Hobbesian situation arose in which, if I were too squeamish to do this, right, you know, then somebody else would do it. When Danton ultimately was too squeamish, then Robespierre got him, right? And gotcha. And so there is a certain descent into terror. That's one reading. The other reading of the terror sees it as emerging, this is the one that Furet mainly gives, sees it as emerging from the ideology of the extreme revolutionaries themselves, a kind of Rousseauian ideology in which there's a conception of vertu, the virtue that you have to have a good republic. This virtue is, interestingly, some idea of a complete fusion between my own personal will and that of, and the general will, that of the general good. And then we see this developing in the discourse of Robespierre, particularly towards the end, the last sort of six-week phase of where there was maximum killing in June and July 1794, where the talk of purification. Virtue is necessary for a republic. There are evil people that are threatening it. We can only have the republic if we get rid of them, kind of purification. And this is as it were, another reading which sees the generation of the terror as purity endogenous to the discourse and the ideology of this particular ruling group. Well, now, you'll see that I'm making a case that neither of these by itself is enough, but something very interesting is happening here, namely, obviously pushed by the situation in which they had to somehow go with the people, that brought out and brought to the fore an already existing discourse, which could do what? Which could offer something like, something structurally similar to this popular culture of revolt, but rationalized differently. That is, like the popular culture, there was an intense sense of moralization and personal responsibility. Everything that went wrong, as you know, in the discourse of Robespierre, was the result of a complot. Right? There was some plot somewhere, un complot aristocratique, complot. There were always plots. And secondly, that there had to be retributory violence, and thirdly, that this violence had ultimately a purificatory function. So what you get is something like the re-editing, if you want to put it this way, kind of re-editing of an older scenario, the telling of an older story, but in a new frame. Right? And this frame had the effect of moralizing and rationalizing, right? As against the violence which seemed quite horrifying and without proper proportion to the middle class of the popular revolt, you had one which would be entirely justified by very high moral principles. The ritual would be some kind of tribunal, maybe a very fast tribunal, but some kind of tribunal. The death would be administered with the maximum, as it were, cleanness. The guillotine, of course, is a beautifully clean death. And what is interesting is that what you have with Robespierre is a kind of purification and purging of certain kinds of popular culture. What you see in the popular culture before, a very important part of it, is that it had features like carnival, that is, profound ambivalence of carnival. That the moment of perhaps greatest gruesomeness was the moment of great hilarity, kind of jokes. I mean, in 1789, somebody was, one of the sort of ruling stratum, was thought to have said, people have no bread to eat, let them eat hay. And he was brought in, and he was totally, hay was tied around his neck, and so on. Jokes, etc., were made. But this was not just good, clean fun. This part of a ritual which ended with the guy losing his head. So you have this mixture of hilarity and the serious, which is part of very age-old popular culture, if you like. And just as in another department of this European civilizing process, to use Elias's phrase, earlier kinds of carnival were totally suppressed, and their elements of hilarity and seriousness were ripped apart and sort of cleaned up. So here you have in the Robespierrean terror a kind of cleaning up of the original popular culture. But again, we have some of the same structures which continue. Now, let me look at another context, which is ethnic cleansing. And here we have something parallel and similar, but quite different. Just a quick word at the end about the French Revolutionary case. Of course, the terror itself disappears from the scene relatively early with Thermidor. I just want to mention what this leaves behind. What it leaves behind, of course, is a very important tradition among revolutionaries, a kind of scenario of what a revolution should be like among extreme revolutionaries, who go on with the idea that it has to have this kind of purgative element, right? Even Babeuf, who was himself very horrified by the early Robespierre, his movement, the radical movement, buys into that, and of course the Bolsheviks buy into that in spades. I mean, what I want to leave us with is the paradox of this revolutionary movement, whose goal is the exact opposite of this, is a degree of peace and pacification hitherto unreached in human history. The paradox is expressed perfectly by the fact that Robespierre in 1791, in the making of the Constitution of the Constituante, voted against the death penalty. Right? There should, in the new republic, there should be no death penalty. Right? George Bush, take note, right? But this same figure, you see, is the one who is egging people on. That, I think, is part of the paradox that we have to see and explain. Now, something similar can be seen with the rise of the modern nation. We have this new idea of a new agency, the people or nation. And here you have, at the outset of this, another beautiful, harmonious picture. That is, nations are thought to be plural because they're meant to coexist together in the kind of Herderian theory, peacefully, as different, respecting each other's difference. But somehow the opposite is often generated from this. How does this happen? Well, it happens on the way to that paradise, as it were, through the following mechanisms. This new idea of a people as sovereign requires something that I want to call a political identity. That is, some understanding of what the people, as a collective agency, are united around. Being united takes the form very often of vigorous discussion of what to do. That's what popular sovereignty requires. But without some kind of sense of what it's all about, what it centers on, it's not possible to have this kind of discussion. That is, if people were on totally different tracks, they would be talking past each other. And these notions of what it's all about are very often centered on certain elements of principle, certain principles of political life, human rights, democracy, representative government. But they also, of course, centered very often on things like ethnic heritage, language, the history we have in common. Well, now, in virtue of this very new idea of popular sovereignty, that the sovereignty in a given territory reposes with the people, there is a new source of sense of threat or impurity which arises, namely that there be on our territory people who cannot or won't belong to, accept the political identity. Cannot or won't, I mean, classically the most obvious cases are the cases where they are people who belong to the wrong ethnic group. But there are other cases of the other kind. I mean, you have the émigrés who are not less French than anyone else who were read out of the French Republic. You have the United Empire loyalists who fled the United States. So, I mean, there are people, there can be people of exactly the same ethnic group, but their exclusion comes because the definition here is accepting certain political principles, and of course you have kulaks and etc. in the Russian case, whose crime is not ethnic either, right? But the ones we think of today as a result of the events in the Balkans are ethnic. And here you have the following very deep problem, that in virtue of the principle of legitimacy of popular sovereignty, these people are a legitimacy threat, can be seen as a legitimacy threat. See, as the worrying thing here is that as against earlier empires, such as the Khan Ka in his great days and so on, and the Ottoman Empire, etc., which very often seem to moderns as examples of possible coexistence between different religious groups, let's say, or different national groups, without fighting, with the rise of democratic legitimacy came a new series of extremely severe conflicts and, if you like, issues. If you think of the coming of independence and democracy in the Indian subcontinent, the replacement of the British Raj by what everybody came to see would be a new self-governing unit, the issue arises of the political identity now. That is, what is this Raj, new Raj, going to consist in? Right? Say Muslims in a worried tone of voice, is it going to be Hindu Raj? Is that what? And others say no, and this doesn't satisfy the Muslims, and you have the basis for a rapid unraveling. But more than that, you have the basis for a great sense of legitimacy threat. You might say identity threat, that is, threat to the political identity, in the existence of minorities on the territory who won't or can't. I mean, either they don't want to, or you won't let them, I mean, whatever it is, they belong to the ethnic. So one of the responses to this, of course, is attempted assimilation, forced inclusion. The predicament of the Kurds in modern Turkey is rather the kind that, not that they aren't, they're excluded in the sense that Muslims were from certain parts of India and are by the BJP, for instance, but rather that they're, well, the BJP is trying to include the Muslims too in a kind of, it's the same kind of thing. You've got to change yourself so that you conceive yourself differently and then you can belong to us. But that, of course, can lead in the end to the same kind of ethnic cleansing. So here you have another re-editing within the modern context of peoples as minorities as having this potential to undo everything that we are founding our society on. Now you might say, in virtue of the fact that the original surrounding idea here is that there are many nations and they all should have their place in the sun, whence comes this idea? Well, this, that they are threats to us and they have to be dealt with. Well, because the higher level, if you might say, of moralization, that is, of turning things into moral issues, is what I mean by, of turning things into moral issues, which belongs to this modern culture, means that their being there as a threat can be used to portray them as aggressors. They are threatening us. The identity threat can be turned into a life threat. We can discuss some of this in the discussion period afterwards, because there's a lot of detail here I don't want to go into at the moment without totally blowing apart the general shape of this talk. And we get once more this kind of terrible alchemy in which, in the name of what ultimately is a very good picture, a beautiful picture of peaceful coexistence of different nations, you get the re-editing of the scenario of purification. And people say things like, the local figure, Mr. Haider, I'm sorry to refer to, says things like, I mean, it's fine to have Poles and so on, but out there in Poland, right? As long as they go where they belong, it's okay. And many BJP people in India say Muslims are okay, but they belong in Pakistan. In other words, they are playing on the original Herderian picture, right? Different nations coexisting, but they're playing on it in such a way that these people being here is aggression. And then you get the whole thing continues. Now, there is a way of in which this violence, of course, is contained. One of the important features of the modern moral order, the polite society, which has developed, I mean, the inheritor of the best examples of polite society, and I mean self-designated examples of polite society in the 18th century, is now undoubtedly, generally speaking, sort of North Atlantic, relatively ordered democracies, in which there is a containment of violence within certain very strong structures of law, which have very powerful hold on people. But underneath that, within these very liberal societies, some of the same mechanisms which generate various kinds of hate, which in other contexts break out into violence, are still operative, interestingly operative, and they have certain analogies. I mean, for instance, take a certain very common liberal stance, and this is not liberalism itself, but this is a very common liberal stance that sees a lot of the evils that happen in the world, and including violence and poverty and so on, as something that is not really the agent's fault, some problem to do with the system, some problem to do with how they're trained and so on. There is a kind of disengaged stance to these phenomena. Instead of going in with moral blame, one goes in with a sense of here's a problem that needs to be fixed. And there's a very frequent adoption of the therapeutic stance, the triumph of the therapeutic in Philip Reeve's sense, that we look at these problems in a therapeutic context, there's some kind of illness here that needs fixing and treatment, rather than these are a lot of evil people. Now that seems like a perfect antidote to the practice of making oneself feel good, referring oneself as good by projecting evil onto the other. It seems to be the exact opposite of that. We're saying, no, we're not dealing with evil here. We're dealing with people that are incapacitated in various ways and not a way of dealing with it. But as, in my view, Dostoevsky showed with brilliant insight way back when, there is a potential slippery slope here in which precisely seeing people as problems, as having problems, as psychological or other kind of problems, as against being responsible, while it disculpates them at one level and doesn't treat them as evil, treats them as in some way incapacitated and inferior, and there can develop from this standpoint a great contempt for the people concerned, which is entirely consistent, indeed encourages very often, pushing them around in a kind of very vigorous way. Think of the way in which politically correct people in liberal society look on the actions of the violent or people who are don't accept certain principles of equality or feminism and so on. The idea is that they're at some kind of lower level of human responsibility than we are because we see these things. And we can force them to shape up. For instance, we can use against them a regime of part coercion, part shaming, right? Simply as the way of getting them back and getting them to shape up. The political correct with, let's say, homophobes, misogynists, and so on, is to have a regime of coercion and or compulsory education or shaming or all three. Now here is recurring something like a kind of latent holy anger, and the anger of the righteous against the. The distancing strategy, in other words, is becoming a cover for another strategy of affirming one's own rightness by the, in this case, the incapacity of the others. Moreover, the temptation is to go even farther and to find some real moral scapegoats. In other words, for instance, people who argue that it's not their fault, that is the fault of these particular people who are violent or misogynist and so on. It's the fault of the system. However, there is some kind of mechanism operating here which I'm not quite sure I understand, but I will try to explain it in the following way. If we are those of goodwill, and that is the ultimate axiom here, the axiom has to be saved in order to have the sense of action and power here. If we are those of goodwill and we're not succeeding in getting things right, making things right. There have to be some who are opposing us, who are those of bad will. So, if the fault is with the system, the particular enemy who stands directly opposite us as the agents of bad will not be the people who are incapacitated by the system, but they will be those who are defending the system and keeping it going. So you get this kind of generating of the same kind of polarized consciousness of good versus evil, which we see presiding over the violent cases. However, here, fortunately held in check by a structure of law and civility which stops it becoming really violent. But there is a kind of latent violence which can come out in the way in which people are treated, in, I mean, much less striking way, in the way in which people are treated in institutions, etc., etc. And that brings me to the last of the cases I want to give before I try a rapid sort of look at where we've got in all this. Well, just one more thing, one penultimate point, just that there's another interesting way that doesn't fit into a neat picture at all. This isn't a neat picture, in which violence recurs in the world, and that is, I want to speak particularly in connection with this liberal disengagement, distancing, objectification, lowering of the metaphysical temperature, denial of the metaphysical and religious dimension of all this. And that is that that has definitely caused a very powerful reaction, which I think one can perhaps emblematize with the name Friedrich Nietzsche as an example. That is, among people who think that this is a kind of demeaning picture of human nature which takes out the greatness, the heroism, and so on. And I could go on a great length, I'm sure we could all go on a great length, how this, in the last 120 years, has splayed out in all sorts of ways into elite culture and sometimes developing into real movements in mass culture of a violent kind. Particularly, I'm thinking of fascism. But let's just hang that hanging as another route to violence in the modern world for a minute and come back to the main line of the argument. And that is, the last thing I want to talk about is what Girard calls le souci de la victime. That is the extraordinary idea, what would have astonished our forefathers many centuries ago. Forefathers who were, anyway, those who were in the upper class, the ones that we know about from history, who were therefore very deeply imbued with various kinds of warrior and honor ethic, where one always wanted to paint oneself as one of the warriors, one of the great, one of the agathoi, you know, if you speak of the original Greek use of this term. Now, everybody is trying to show, I'm the victim. I'm not the great, powerful guy walking over the world. We are the victims, and those other guys are the ones that are the powerful ones walking over the world. Something very astonishing has happened, which I think Girard rightly attributes to Christianity, and Nietzsche would agree, right, from different standpoints here, that there is now a kind of cachet in being the victim. However, just as with the case of Robespierre, who votes for the death for the absence of the death penalty, and the picture of nations all existing, coexisting together, what seems to underlie this, which is an infinite sympathy for the victim, becomes precisely in the way in which it's understood narratively as being operative in history, becomes the basis for new kinds of violence. Because the idea is, my being the victim, the main point in a certain sense of my being the victim is that you are, there isn't a word for this, le bourreau, we say in France. I mean, you are the victimizer, let's put it that way, right? If I'm the victim, those other people are the victimizers. And being the victim gives me tremendous rights to do things, including being violent, because this rapidly gets metaphysicized and essentialized. We are the victims, so we can't really do wrong here, right? It's those other people who are the victimizers who are the ones doing wrong. Can I tell you a very funny story, just for a couple of seconds, against me and my society? There was in Quebec, naturally here, I go back to my home base here, the commissioner for the official languages in Ottawa gave his annual report, and he said the state of the official languages and their equality in Canada, and he said at one point that recent legislation in Quebec was humiliating for the English-speaking minority recent. And the premier called together the National Assembly and got them, this is a moment of great, for me, great shame, he got them to vote a unanimous resolution, so arm twisting people to vote for this, that on the contrary, you know, those who were humiliated here, were us, the French-speaking majority, and couldn't be the English. It was impossible. I mean, this is against the... We were the designated humiliated... We were the designated victims of this situation. It was a perfect example of this kind of metaphysical thinking of victimage in operation, and a kind of immediate response that there was something indecent about claiming for these other people the status of victim, of those who were humiliated. In this case, the notion of humiliation was the central notion. But I think you see a perfect example. Here are grown men and women who, you know, in politics should know about these things and how relative all these things are, being dragooned into this vote. It really was a very saddening sight, but also very, very revelatory about the way in which this operates. And we can see very often this logic operating. We have suffered terribly, so we can do anything. Many of the various terrorist movements of the 1970s on have used this kind of argument. We are at the bottom, so therefore we can. And here you have a perfect example of the same basic structure of, as it were, producing innocence for oneself through discovering the contrast case, the one that has to be fought, the evil ones, and that is the basis very often for violence. But where, again, as I said earlier, where it isn't the basis for violence, it can be the basis for some kinds of hatreds that indeed come close to violence and bring violence close. Okay, let me try to draw this together. What does all this mean for us in our age about violence? Well, a couple of things come up from this, not from what I talked about at great length, but things I just mentioned in passing first. That, of course, one of the important ramparts against violence are these ordered democratic societies. And there is the famous Kant hypothesis, but Kant was not the only one, right, who said that. The existence of republics, I mean, let's add to Kant, democratic republics all over the world would bring an end to war because democratic republics don't go to war with each other. Some people claim this today, and there are unfortunate counterexamples, but there are less counterexamples than there are of the other kind. So there's something to this, right? These structures of law that hopefully prevent civil war and then also engage less in general violent war. Now, the recent NATO action in Kosovo, right, shows that, well, this is not a democratic society going to war with a democratic society, but this shows that these various victimage mechanisms and fingerings of enemies and joy in that and a sense of self-righteousness in that, just listen to Tony Blair and so on, these are not absent from our society, but there is a tendency for them not to happen in their worst form, touch wood, within. But this piece, of course, is fragile for a host of reasons, partly because there are certain success conditions of the economic order, etc., which allow these systems of law to go on, holding the allegiance of the majority of their members. So certainly part of the policy you would think of in order to face contemporary violence would be trying to build such ordered democratic polities. Secondly, trying to make sure their benefits are spread as wide as possible so that the phenomena of young unemployed men in East Germany and so on becoming skinheads, etc., doesn't repeat itself or repeats itself as little as possible. But what do we say that, of course, doesn't deal with, if you like, this metaphysical level? And on the metaphysical level, there are two kinds of views that people put forward. One is the whole thing comes from the original religious background, metaphysical background of all this. Let's push forward further in the demetaphysicization, disenchantment, secularization of our world. Let's push the metaphysical and religious out to the borders, and then finally we'll get to the point where this won't exist anymore. That, for reasons that I think explained in my talk, doesn't convince me at all. Okay, second hypothesis. Let's return to religion, right? But of course, that shouldn't convince us either, because it's not because The original sources of this are in more primitive religion, because presumably when people talk of returning to religion, they mean something like Christianity and so on. But Christianity shows in its history this incredible, I mean, the Christendom, this incredible capacity. Girard has shown, I think, brilliantly how the Old Testament and the New Testament can be seen as a sustained argument that the whole victim scenario is deeply wrong, that the victim is right as against being properly the victim, and so on, culminating in the New Testament and the Passion. Nevertheless, Christendom managed to re-edit exactly that scenario with, for instance, anti-Semitism or witchcraft. So there, this is no bulwark against them. So what remains in this third category? Well, I think what remains are very interesting and powerful punctual moves you see here and there, where people make a move which undoes the categorizations of violence, the categorizations of they are evil, we are good, of violence. And one of the most prominent in my mind at the moment, because this is, you know, it's happened recently, is Nelson Mandela and the whole way in which he came out from prison and proposed to build the Republic and had a great influence in doing so, in particular the way in which this worked out with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I'm not saying it's going to be a success. I mean, you know, it's too early to see whether that society will avoid certain of the worst kinds of conflict. You know, we're fingers crossed. But here you have a very interesting move made, not on these two first levels of, you know, building an ordered society and making sure people are included, but on this other move of changing, of undermining the whole metaphysical basis for victimage. What could be more understandable than people emerging from that regime who were previously repressed by it and just want, you know, get back? You know, any one of us, I mean, most of us normal human beings after 27 years in Robben Island would just be, you know, waiting to get out and get those guys. And here you have a very exceptional human being, the right place and the right time, with tremendous charisma, and you get the possibility of undoing some of these categorizations. And here I think you have somebody working at the, what I want to call the real metaphysical level, the way in which these modes of violence are nourished by various very deep scenarios that we are tempted to play and replay and replay. Right? So my prescription, as it were, for the modern world is to, of course, don't cease being operative on these first two levels, but think of being operative on the third level, because in some cases, see, it's not just that you want to build a ordered democratic polity over here and then work on the metaphysics over there. In some cases, like the South Africa of Mandela, maybe doing that is necessary to building this, to building the ordered polity. It's a, perhaps a precondition. It might turn out that history will show that that move made it possible to build such an ordered polity, whereas the absence of it would not. And I'm thinking, then we have the whole set of issues around this, which we can see in the recently like liberated despotic societies like those in Eastern Europe and so on, and the stand of people like Mishnik and so on, right or wrong, against turning it around and adopting punitive measures against those who were in the previous regime. And all these various attempts to manage these transitions have very often been shot through with moves that had a certain sensitivity to this level that I am now talking about. So what I'm trying to say at the end is that what it all comes down to in terms of politics, if you like, is that there is a third level here that we need to think of, and that I don't think I've succeeded, but understanding these mechanisms, which I've been struggling towards in a kind of confused manner, understanding these mechanisms is an essential part of operating on that third level, without which we will not be able to move farther. Well, thank you very much for your very kind attention.